From the city centre, we are Cambridge 105.
Welcome to the last of Cambridge 105's election studio broadcasts with me, Sam Davis. Our aim for these shows has been to give you a real insight into the personalities and the policies of the candidates standing for election as your MP in either the Cambridge City or the South Cambridgeshire constituency. In this final episode, and with only a few days to go before polling day, we meet the two heavy hitters who are currently neck and neck in the contest for the Cambridge City seat. Daniel Zeichner of the Labour Party and Julian Huppert of the Liberal Democrats. The latest polling makes it clear that, unlike the situation in South Cambs, the result in the city seat is far too close to call. And so we're delighted that both candidates have been able to take time out of a hectic last week of campaigning to call into the Cambridge 105 studio.
Daniel Zeichner's website describes the Labour candidate as a lifelong Cambridge resident, but it was in the constituency of Mid Norfolk where he first stood for Parliament three times in 1997, 2001 and 2005. He was also a councillor in South Norfolk from 1995 to 2003. Mr Zeichner first stood in Cambridge in 2010, but was knocked into third place by the Conservatives. At 58, Mr Zeichner is the oldest of the candidates standing in Cambridge. He now works for the trade union Unison, campaigning on behalf of the low paid. He's against the privatisation of local health services, a process begun under the last Labour administration, and has taken a strong stance against the spare room subsidy, known to many as the bedroom tax. Will May the 7th be fifth time lucky for Daniel Zeichner?
So, my first guest today is Daniel. Welcome to Cambridge 105.
Very good to be here again, thanks.
As we've mentioned, Cambridge is probably one of the most closely contested seats in England, and it looks set to go right to the wire. You ran against Julian in 2010 and lost. What's going to be different this time?
I have to say the whole feeling in this election is completely different. 2010 was a hard election to fight as a Labour candidate. I think I knew from a long time before polling day what was coming. And it wasn't a great result for us here in Cambridge, but it wasn't a great result for Labour across the country. But I've done quite a few elections over the years now, and you get a feel for when things have changed. Last year, I remember knocking up in Romsey at near the school, and as parents were coming out, they saw the rosettes and they were smiling. And I have to tell you that in 2010, that wasn't what was happening on the streets at all. And we're seeing a lot of that at the moment. When I walk up and down Mill Road, when I walk around the town, people are stopping me saying, "Hi, Daniel, good luck." It's very different. Now, how the numbers fall, I can't tell you, but I think it's very different.
So your reading of the situation is that there's a much more positive vibe. I guess that's kind of how it ought to be, really. I mean, after 5 years of a coalition austerity government, clearly there is among some sections of the population an appetite for change. I guess what's surprising is that you personally and the party nationally haven't pulled out more of a definitive lead at this point.
Well, if you look back historically, I'm old enough to remember a long period of elections when Labour used to do really well for 5 years until the day it mattered. And on the day it mattered, we lost. So I'd settle for smaller leads through the period when there aren't any elections and a win on Thursday. I think politics has actually changed quite a lot. It's obvious that we've got more parties, that the vote is fragmenting more. So it's not quite the same as it was in the 80s and 90s. But I think in this city now, people are beginning to focus on the real choice. The truth is, if Labour doesn't win in Cambridge, it's almost certain there'll be another Conservative government. And the sense I got of the last election, and in fact Tony Juniper, who was the Green candidate at the last election, and I wrote a joint letter after the election, because what we said was, both of us had canvassed the whole city, and on so many doorsteps people had said the same thing: "Oh, I can't quite make up my mind, I'm undecided." And we'd ask, "Who are you choosing between?" And it would almost always be between Labour, Liberal Democrat and Green. Cambridge is not a Conservative city anymore, in my view. And what we said afterwards was, how is it that a progressive city like Cambridge, their representative, can go to Parliament and effectively put our tick in the Conservative box? And that's what this election is really about, because if the Liberal Democrats win Cambridge, they will be in coalition with the Conservatives for 5 years, but in a much weaker coalition, because there'll be fewer of them. And I think Cambridge wants a more progressive government. And that's why I'm saying to people who are thinking of voting Green, think really carefully, because what you will inadvertently do, And you probably won't realise this necessarily in advance, but what you might inadvertently do is end up putting Cameron, Duncan Smith and Gove and all those people you really don't trust back in charge for 5 years.
All right, well, we can come on to some of the possible permutations of coalition government later on in this interview, but can we start by looking at some aspects of Labour Party policy?
Sure.
And this being Cambridge, housing would seem like an obvious place to start. So in common with the other parties, you're proposing a sizeable building programme. And then on top of that, you've recently introduced this element to do with the rental market. In particular, 3-year tenancies and a cap on rent increases. The sense I got was that those have been fairly much a last-minute addition. I mean, I've seen an interview with the shadow housing minister, Emma Reynolds, which was only recorded a month ago, in which she flatly denies that Labour has any intention of introducing rent controls. How would you respond to the thought that these things have been introduced on the fly and actually are flawed because they'll reduce flexibility in the housing market?
Well, I have to say I'm a bit surprised about that because when Ed Miliband's visited Cambridge a lot over the last year, and I think it was last November he came here and announced a big change in Labour thinking about the extent to which you intervene in the private rented market. Because, you know, truth told, over the last 20, 30 years, there's been a kind of consensus that you don't intervene in markets too much. And that was one of the criticisms that some people make of the new Labour period. The big thing that's characterised Ed Miliband's leadership is that where markets aren't working for consumers, you do intervene. So whether it's the energy market, the rail market, or the private rental market. So I think this was signalled pretty clearly back in November. Now, the finer detail has come later. And let's be clear, full-blown rent controls, that's not what we're saying. And in some parts of the world, that has been tried. In fact, we used to have them in this country. And part of the danger is it throttles investment in the market. And that doesn't help us because we know people need places to live and landlords need to be able to get a return. But we think the balance of power between landlords and tenants is now wrong. It's out of kilter. And the reason we've come up with this, which is halfway house, if you like, to rent controls, is we'd listen to what people have been telling us. In a city like Cambridge, because people can't afford to buy their own homes anymore, far more people, young families, are in the private rented sector. In the old days, when it was just kind of like a short-term fix as people moved through to buying their own homes, maybe it didn't matter that you had to move every 6 months. But if you've got families with children at local schools and you suddenly find you've got to move, this is really disruptive. And what we've been hearing more and more with the pressure on the sector is not only is it disruptive for families, but every 6 months, if you're given a choice between paying a rent increase or moving, that's really, really hard. So that's why we think 3-year tenancies is the norm. It's not absolute, it's not the case that it can't be negotiated both ways if that's not appropriate, but that would be the norm. And capping the increases to no more than inflation, plus saying that the landlord has to tell you what was the previous rental, because that's not always clear to people. We think that is fair, good for tenants, and actually what a lot of landlords tell us is actually some stability doesn't do them any harm either. So we think it's the right balance, and I think for a place like Cambridge, I mean, over a quarter of people in this city now rent in the private rented sector, and the figures on rent rises are different depending on who you talk to, but some of the online property sites have been suggesting as much as a 25% increase in rents in the last year in Cambridge. I think just yesterday or today, the average figure for a 2-bedroom property in Cambridge, £1,100 and something, nearly £1,200 a month. Well, you look at a lot of people's pay packets and you think, how much is left out of that? Not a lot.
I want to ask a very quick follow-up on that, sure. Which is I have read, I don't know if this is true or not, but I have read that a lot of buy-to-let mortgages actually specify that you can only have it on the basis of a maximum, offering a maximum 12-month tenancy. Is this actually practically deliverable upon if you come into government?
Well, look, like with all these policies, legislation, when you actually get the House of Commons, you go through the fine detail, and there will be a lot of fine detail to go through. But basically, I'm going to Parliament to make the law. And if we make the law, then other things have to follow. Can I just say finally, I mean, I think we're seeing some very interesting examples in and around Cambridge. If you look at the new developments in Trumpington, I canvassed them over the summer, and they're lovely places. They look very, very expensive. They are expensive. But what I found there was the vast majority of people are renting because they've been bought as investments, often from people from not in this country. And that doesn't feel quite right, that we've had this big debate around Cambridge, around where the new home's going to be. If all that happens is they're bought up as investment opportunities, there's something not quite right. So I think it's absolutely right that Labour's intervening.
Another area where you're looking to intervene is in the management of zero-hours contracts. You want to do away with zero-hours contracts.
Not all. But
Okay, maybe you can clarify for me then. I mean, I have read that many businesses, particularly in sectors with lots of seasonal variation like tourism, think that 0 hours contracts make good business sense for them. And that's not because they're rapaciously trying to exploit their employees. That's just the nature of their business sector. And also that many workers like the flexibility that a 0 hours contract gives them. So is this a bit of market intervention which goes too far and is seeking to change things where actually the market can deliver an adequate solution provided people, you know, play fair?
Well, let's just step back. First of all, everywhere we write it, and I have to say this is a problem to find space on some of the leaflets, is we say banning exploitative 0 hours contracts. We fully understand that flexibility can work for both sides. But I have to tell you that most of the people I talk to, and I've been struck by this, the number of people volunteering this on the doorstep in Cambridge now, most people do not want to be on 0 hours contracts. And what it actually goes to the heart of a bigger economic problem. What's the problem with the British economy over the last few years? Why have the coalition been unable to actually do what they said they were going to do, which was eliminate the deficit in this parliament? And the answer is we've got a low wage economy, low productivity economy, and 0 hours contracts are a symptom of that. And that's not going to be the solution for Britain in the future. So it's partly about social justice. And then there is a basic point here that I think for people of my generation who kind of got a job and then sort of knew what was coming in this week, this month, knew when they were going to go to work, it's unimaginable, the idea that you sit at home waiting for your phone to go and you just don't know how much you're going to be paid. Now, that makes it impossible to plan how much rent you can pay, whether you can afford a mortgage. So, yes, for some people it works, but for the majority it doesn't. And what we're saying is if you've had one of these contracts for a period of time, then you're entitled to switch to a proper full-time contract. So, of course, we don't want to throttle the labour market. I mean, the clue's in the name, we're the Labour Party. We believe in work. I work for a trade union nationally. I see that the negotiations we do for people, they just do not want to be in this kind of situation. Care staff, classic example. Very low paid. We entrust, you know, our loved parents in the hands of very low paid workers quite often on these 0 hours contracts. If we want to shift the kind of country we live in, this is exactly the kind of thing we've got to tackle. And the coalition say they've already done this. Well, if they have, it certainly hasn't worked, because the people I'm talking to, and you can go anywhere in Cambridge, it's surprising, it's not just the poorest areas. A lot of young people coming out of university, that's what they're faced with. And it's not the way forward.
Third big strand of Labour Party policy is clearly around the NHS, NHS funding. Everyone agrees that demands on the NHS are only going to increase because the population is increasing, people are living longer, and they have more complex ongoing medical needs because of that ageing process. 50 years ago, the NHS consumed about 3.5% of GDP, and now it's up to just over 8%, I think, so £115 billion a year. Isn't all the to-ing and fro-ing between the parties in this election about putting in an extra £2 billion or £2.5 billion or £8 billion or whatever the number is, just hot air? Because no one is prepared to admit that maintaining an NHS on current lines just is not possible in the medium term.
Not true. Okay. Depends upon your priorities. We are a much wealthier country than we were when the National Health Service was established. the naysayers and doom merchants will say, oh, it can't be afforded. Well, of course it can. It's about the choice, isn't it? And I agree with you. The $2.5 billion that Labour has promised to put in, and the difference between that $2.5 billion and, I have to say, the fantasy figures from the Liberal Democrats, I challenged my opponent yesterday on this. He said, oh, we'll find it from somewhere. Well, that's not real politics. We've said exactly where we'll find it, and that's from a mansion tax on very, very expensive properties, which will predominantly be in London. Goes back to the housing point, when the housing market is distorting the economy in that kind of way, taking some money out of that and putting it into what I think is most people's in Britain's top priority, the NHS, seems sensible to us. But actually, the premise of your question is right. Does it? The National Health Service was a service designed for the last century. What Labour's got, and I'm sorry this hasn't got more attention really, is a plan to transform the health service into a health and care service for this century. And it goes to the heart of what the problem actually is at places like Haddon Brooks. You know, A&E, 23,000 people waiting more than 4 hours in the last couple of years at Haddon Brooks. At the end of the Labour period, it was hardly zero. Why? Because they've got so many people in those wards who've got no way of getting out of the hospital. Frail elderly people who need care. What Cameron did when he promised to ring-fence health spending at the last election and derided Labour for not matching it was misunderstand the nature of the problem. Unless the care sector is properly funded, you get this problem in A&E. So what Labour's saying is, we'll pool the budgets, integrate the system, bring mental health services and care services into an integrated care service. We call it whole person care. And I think turning that, and it won't be, this is a hard thing to do, but it's the right way to change it. And interestingly, there was a very controversial privatisation process carried out in Cambridgeshire over the last few years, wasted millions of pounds on it, the tendering of the older people's services. I was a powerful critic of that throughout, but what I was at pains to say always was it was a privatisation element that was wrong. The principle they were trying to establish, which is that you pull the services together and end the perverse financial incentives within the system to move to something called a year of care payment, which basically incentivises the hospital not necessarily to keep people in hospital, but to actually support them elsewhere, is exactly the right way to go. So these are complicated technical issues, but I think Labour is the only party putting forward a really forward-looking plan.
Let's pause the policy discussion for a minute.
I could go on forever on policy. Keep me on it.
In common with everybody else we've had in the studio over the last 4 weeks, I think. Can we do the one-minute round?
Sure, yep.
Okay, describe yourself in three words.
Oh, passionate, radical, forward-looking. That's four words.
What's the last book you read?
Last book I read, we're talking novel or Robert Caro's biography of Lyndon Johnson. Volume 3, I think it was.
Who would you choose to play you in a film of your life?
Who would I choose to play me in a film? It's not something I've ever given much thought to, I have to say, because I don't think it's on the cards at the moment.
But it's the guy that looks
a bit like me, I think, in The Crying Game, but I can't remember his name, his actor. Is it, what's his name, Neeson?
Liam Neeson, yeah. Okay, good answer. What's your guilty pleasure?
Ooh, well, it is chocolate. It's a bit of eBay and probably slobbing out in front of the TV with a glass of wine, I'm afraid. That's too many guilty
that's many
pleasures.
Guilty
that's
pleasures.
Going too far, too far.
And the mum's neck question. What's your favourite biscuit?
Oh, still Jaffa Cakes.
You sound like you are looking for a change there.
Well, it's a bit passé, isn't it? It ought to be something more sophisticated, really.
Back to policy.
This is easier.
Well, you may not have
well,
the
I
same
made, made
view at the end of
there.
This question.
Yeah.
Right, we had the last of the leaders' debates last night.
Yeah.
And I think it's fair to say the consensus arising from that, as with the rest of the campaign, as with much of the preceding 5 years, is that Ed Miliband is struggling to get engagement, is struggling to get Labour's message out there. And there's still a lot of people with reservations about him personally. They can't quite see him as their next Prime Minister. Do you think that's a stupid way of expressing it. You would clearly say that people expressing those doubts are wrong. Why are they wrong?
Because I know him. and I backed him from the very beginning. And actually, I don't agree with quite with the premise of your question. I think people were really surprised to see just how much better Ed is than the picture being painted. He's thoughtful, he's intelligent, he's strong, he's got, I would say, good, decent values. And I just say, there's not been a leader of the opposition who's had such an impact in living memory, as far as I'm concerned. Look, he took on Rupert Murdoch. How brave was that? And that's partly why he's getting so much stick from all those papers that Murdoch owns. He stopped the drift to war in Syria. Really, really important. And he's taken on some of the most powerful energy companies in the country. And again, he's got a lot of criticism for all that. Now, to me, that sounds to me like the kind of leader who you would want to have in a country like ours at the moment. Whereas Cameron, he's slippery and slidey all over the place. And he makes promises that totally fail. He completely got it wrong on immigration. He completely got it wrong on the economy. I mean, remember, he said it would be a moral failure if the deficit wasn't eliminated in this parliament. What's he doing even standing for election after something like that?
Of course you defend your man. I would expect nothing else. How do you feel about the fact that apparently more than 60% of the public believe that both Labour and Conservative would promise anything to get elected? And moving on from that to the promises, the red lines that have been drawn about not going to government with SNP support, I think people find it particularly hard to see how Labour will be able to resist the logic of that if that's the key to them getting into government.
Well, I mean, this goes to the heart of the issue of trust in politics, doesn't it? It's not new, actually. You may remember back in 1997, Labour had a little pledge card, and we had five pledges on it, which I think John Prescott famously couldn't remember at the time. You know, you're going to test me in a minute. I probably still can remember some of them. But a successive election afterwards, I had people saying, oh, you broke all your promises. And I'd ask people, what were they exactly? And they'd have no idea. And I'd say, well, actually, we didn't promise the things you just told me because we knew we couldn't do them. And that's, I think, part of the dilemma, that people have huge expectations and hopes and aspirations. So political parties are often much more cautious. But that's just part of the problem of politics. And things like the famous tuition fee fiasco, which we witnessed here in Cambridge when the Liberal Democrat leader Nick Clegg came here and made a promise he knew he couldn't deliver, but did it anyway. That has really destroyed trust in politics. So I think that's partly why people don't believe what parties say, however hard we try. And that's just, we just have to work with that. But on your question about what might happen after the election, Ed's been very clear on this. We're not going to be doing deals. We're not going to be doing the horse trading. If we win, but we don't have enough seats for an absolute majority, we will put up a Queen's speech and we'll challenge the other parties to support it or not. Now, that's for them to decide whether they support it or not. And I would say with the Scottish Nationalists, you know, they don't like us and we don't like them. I mean, that's fairly obvious from the campaign that's going on in Scotland. There may be some common ground. We'll see. But I tell you, we're going to be a much bigger party than the Scottish Nationalists. And we will set out our programme. Now, if they want to vote it down and put David Cameron and the Tories in, they can go back and explain that to people in Scotland. I think they'll have a hard time doing that.
Fighting talk.
I'm a fighter. This is my fifth election. I intend to win, I tell you.
Okay. Daniel, thank you very much for coming in to talk to us today. We've asked all our interviewees to pick a song to play their interview out. What have you chosen and why?
Well, this is slightly obscure, but it's a classic track. It's All Along the Watchtower, which people remember Bob Dylan, Jimi Hendrix did versions of. But I love the version by Paul Weller. I wasn't a Jam fan in my initial years, but I just think this is a really classic, cool track. And I just love it.
Thank you.
All along the watchtower.
There must be some way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine, plowmen dig my earth. None of them along the line know what any of it is worth. Mm-hmm.
us who feel that life is but a joke. But you and I, we've been through that, and this is not our fate. So let us not talk falsely now. The hour is getting late. All along the watchtower, princes kept their view. While all the women came and went, barefoot servants too. Outside in the cold distance, a wildcat did growl. Two riders were approaching, the wind began to howl.
Welcome back to Cambridge 105's Election Studio with me, Sam Davis. And now, we move on to the last candidate to grace the Election Studio hot seat, Dr. Julian Huppert of the Liberal Democrats.
Research scientist Julian Huppert is looking to become the first Lib Dem to be elected in Cambridge for two successive terms. His predecessor, David Howarth, stood down after one. Dr. Huppert spent 8 years as a councillor on Cambridgeshire County Council for East Chesterton. During this campaign, he's been threatened with legal action by Conservative candidate Shamali Fernando over what was thought, she said, over the wearing of wristbands by mental health patients. He's since apologised. A regular at PMQs, he once complained the groans that occasionally greet him as he gets to his feet was tantamount to bullying. Dr. Huppert has campaigned against the so-called Snoopers Charter for cycling safety and run a local competition to find the best independent shops in Cambridge. In new data released in the past few days, YouGov says the Cambridge result in the general election is too close to call.
It's good to have you with us on Cambridge 105, Julian.
Great to be here, Sam.
My first question, are you really a Liberal Democrat?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, so you're in the top 10% of MPs who've rebelled against the party whip. You have voted against some pretty major pieces of legislation. So, for example, the introduction of benefit caps, against airstrikes on ISIL and military intervention in Syria, and, of course, most famously, against the introduction of tuition fees. If people vote for you this time as a Liberal Democrat, how can they be sure which bits of party policy you will or won't support?
I mean, I think being a Liberal Democrat is about having a values set and a vision. It's about trying to empower people. And I think that's the sort of thing that people would want to see. And I'm not going to apologise for being independent-minded. I actually think increasingly people don't want an MP who will just simply do what the party whips tell them to do, but will stand up for Cambridge and for Cambridge's values. So to take the example of the attacks on Syria, there was a government proposal on the table that we should attack Syria. There was a Labour proposal that we should attack Syria with slight differences. And there was a smallish band of us who disagreed with both of those. And and basically because Cameron and Miliband couldn't get on, we managed to win both votes, astonishingly. But actually, I'm quite proud of doing that. And actually, one of the things I did was to ask my constituents what they thought. I think that's quite an important thing to do. So everyone I had an email address for, not everybody, I'd love to get more, I asked, and most people felt again that we shouldn't attack Syria. So I do think that's important. And things like tuition fees, I stuck to what I'd always said. I kept my promise. If I'm re-elected, I'll happily keep my promises again.
And I know at the hustings last night, Daniel Zeichner spoke about identifying Cambridge red lines. We're hearing lots and lots and lots about the party's overall red lines, about what deals they will cut with whom. Daniel mentioned Cambridge red lines. What would your Cambridge red lines then be if you're looking to do such a focused job of representing this constituency?
Well, I think it's to continue many of the things I've pressed on already. I mean, one of the things, for example, would be education funding here. We've been underfunded for many decades, and we were actually the worst funded in the entire country. Completely unacceptable. And it meant that pupils, particularly from poorer backgrounds, simply were not getting the help they needed. Not because the teachers weren't doing their jobs or anything like that. There just was a lot less cash, about 250,000 quid for a typical primary school. Yeah, it's a huge gap. something that I'd pushed on for ages, and as the MP was really able to prioritise. And so we've got an extra £23.2 million coming for the county schools as of, well, now last month. But that's only about half the gap. So a really important priority for me would be to get a national fair funding formula. And it's something which I wrote into our party manifesto. I'm one of the people who wrote our manifesto. I'll be one of the people on the reference group if there are any coalition discussions later on. So I'm in quite a strong position to make sure that what I want actually happens. So education would be one of them. I think transport would be another really important one. We've got the Science Park station, which I again pressed for 15 years, being built finally. But I want to see more progress on things like East-West Rail, a new station at Addenbrookes, powers to allow us to regulate buses here in Cambridge, like in London. So we can really start to improve what's happening, much more for walking and for cycling, because we have to tackle our congestion. Again, the city deal's great, but there's more to go in terms of devolving powers so that we can do a better job on transport. Housing's the other one. One of the things, again, in our manifesto, because I pushed for it, is to allow councils to borrow to build houses. And I think that's really important. We lost a huge number of social homes under Thatcher, and then the last government sold off 421,000 net, which gives us a huge housing crisis. So I'd like to see councils able to borrow to do that, much more affordable housing, more house building altogether, because otherwise we're going to have a Cambridge where you can't get about and you can't afford to live.
Some of us would argue we're already there, but we will.
It could be worse, and it has to get better.
Okay. So you've already mentioned there some of the key themes that are coming up time after time in discussion of party policy. What I'm interested in is your approach to the welfare budget. Mm. Now, my understanding is that the Liberal Democrats have put what they call a triple lock guarantee on pension rises, which I think means that they will rise each year by whichever is the highest measure of inflation, average salary rises, or a maximum of 2.5%.
Yep.
Am I right there? Okay. By contrast, the Liberal Democrats want to cap benefit increases at 1% for at least the first 2 years of the next parliament. Why are pensioners so much more deserving of further guaranteed rises than working age voters when they've already been protected so much more under the last government?
I think this is a really interesting question. I have a lot of sympathy for what you're saying. I think it is important to help pensioners. We still have pensioner poverty in this country. It's coming down partly because of the triple lock that we've put in. So whereas we used to have the derisory, 75p increase, we've actually seen very large increases in pensions, which helps because if somebody's dependent on the state pension, it's pretty tough. And part of the issue is that if you take a 75, 80-year-old dependent on the state pension, they don't really have the option of finding a job to do something about it. So they don't have that choice. In terms of welfare, actually, this is something where I don't agree entirely with my party. And in fact, when we had the, I think it was called the benefits uprating bill, which suggested that there should be this 1% increase, I and a number of my colleagues rebelled against it because I think I'd like to see benefits match to inflation. I think that's the right thing to do. And we've said as a party we would definitely do that for anything to do with disability because, again, that's not, it's harder to do anything about. And actually, it was a fascinating debate because the bill said the rate should go up by 1%. I and other colleagues said, no, it should go up with inflation or at least in line with wages. I could see the argument for tying it to wages. Labour just wouldn't say what they would do. They had an amendment that would take out the by 1%. And when many of us pressed them on what would it be, more or less than 1%, we got no answer. I remember that debate vividly. But actually, I think we should have a safety net that's there for people. It shouldn't be, we have to get rid of things like benefit traps, and I've seen a number of constituents where, I remember one vividly a few months after I'd been elected, who had found, she'd had a whole series of problems, she'd been on drugs, a range of things, finally sorted herself out, had a flat, was living with her daughter, I think, and got a job, finally, she felt ready to work. And it was, if I remember correctly, 16 hours a week stacking shelves. And she discovered that she ended up with less money than before she had it, and she came to see me because she was now in arrears. That's not okay. So we have to make sure we don't cause those sort of benefit traps where you're better off not working. That just makes no sense at all. But we should make sure it is a decent amount.
Another form of state dependency comes to mind when I look at one aspect of your education policy. I don't want to go through the whole tuition fees debate again. I think it's been done to death, and I think most people locally would understand how you arrived at your stance on that, how the party arrived at its stance on it.
And I mean, the only thing I would say on that is it was quite heartening that 3 days ago, the National Union of Students, which is a very Labour-leaning organisation, came out very much in favour of me and produced a lovely piece, the MP who kept his pledge, praising me for all my work for the students. So, you know, it's nice to know that the NUS reward people who actually deliver for students and stick to their promise.
OK, what I would like to query is the thinking behind the allocation of just over £600 million to extend the provision of free school meals to the 7 to 11 age group. I wonder what's wrong with expecting parents who can afford it to provide a meal for their child, because, A, it could be perceived as being incredibly patronising to suggest that schools know better what the child should have, or have the child's interest more at heart than their parents. And secondly, just you've talked about the funding problems that, that schools have. Aren't there better things to be spending the money on?
So it's actually, I mean, it's a really interesting question, because this is something that was piloted. It was piloted for infant schools. And what we found actually was that it was a very positive intervention. The pupils did a lot better as a result, partly because free school meals weren't quite allocated correctly. There were people who didn't apply, who possibly should have benefited from them, who didn't ever get them. But partly there was a really interesting factor in that it was the pupils who were already getting free school meals who benefited the most. It's a really interesting outcome. They were already getting the meals, but they gained the most when everyone else got them as well. And I suspect my interpretation of what the studies show is that it's because it gets rid of the stigma. That one of the problems, if you have some pupils who get free school meals every day, is you're reminding them every day that they're in this category of being poorer. And when you get rid of that and everybody gets it, they don't feel separated. They don't feel divided from other pupils. I mean, that's just my interpretation of the data, but it's quite clear that the benefit does go mostly to them. So I do think it's a really good thing. It binds the pupils together. Now, of course, no...
United in their hatred of soggy cabbage, presumably.
Well, actually, the food has been a lot better. I've had some of these free school meals, and actually the kids really loved them. The teachers really thought they were very good. I think I'd suggest having a go. The meals are much better than you might think they could be. And as I say, the kids really loved it. So it's a good thing for the school, it's a good thing for the pupils, it's a good thing for the parents. Now, no parent is forced to have their kid eat the free school meal, but it's on offer for everybody, and I think that is important.
All right. Can we talk about the NHS?
Very definitely.
I'm going to ask you the same question that I've asked Daniel Zeichner on this topic. When we have more people who are living longer and experiencing more complex medical needs, I think the term is
comorbidity.
Comorbidity, that's the one. Can any amount of money we throw at the NHS in its current form be anything more than a short-term sticking plaster?
I mean, I think this is one of the central challenges for the NHS. If you look back to when it was set up, you know, fantastic thing set up by the Labour government. It was a liberal idea. Lord Beveridge was a great liberal. But if you look back at the debates, it was always envisaged that it would become cheaper to run the NHS every year because people would be healthier. And what's happened instead is that we can do much more. People live much longer. It becomes more and more expensive. And that is a massive challenge. So my view is you have to get the money in, and you have to also improve the efficiency. There's a lot you can do with prevention. You know, I was talking to Keith McNeil at Addenbrookes, and you can do various blood tests and identify that people are likely to require permanent dialysis because they'll have kidney problems a few years beforehand and in time to change it, and he's implemented that elsewhere. That's much cheaper. So we need to make sure people get the provision they need, but if we can get them not to need it, that's obviously much better. So the chief executive of NHS England, Simon Stevens, has done an analysis, 5-year forward look, and says that by 2020, there'll be 30 billion, but he reckons they can save 22 billion by being more efficient, by doing more prevention, leaving 8 billion as a bare minimum of extra cash that's needed. That's quite a lot less than the total. I think it'll be quite tight, by the way. My view is that as politicians, we shouldn't be fiddling around with the fine details of every bit of the health system. but we should make sure that it gets that money. And that's why we've insisted on £8 billion being available by 2020. We said that at the beginning of this year. We set out how we would pay for it. It involves closing a number of tax loopholes for wealthy people. There's a whole range of things, getting rid of some schemes, because you have to get that cash in. And then in general, we wouldn't fiddle with the details. The one thing I would say is that the bit of the NHS that is always ignored, massively under-supported and creates huge costs elsewhere, is mental health. And for decades, mental health has been the poor cousin of physical health. So one place I would intervene is to get a total of £3.5 billion into mental health. We've got some of that already, £1.25 billion for child and adolescent mental health, for pregnant women and new mothers where there are particular problems. We've got money for eating disorders as well. I mean, anorexia and bulimia are some of the biggest killers of young people. So we have to get mental health taken much more seriously and to get rid of the stigma that there is around it.
So you've just identified one of the ways of keeping demands on the NHS down are by preventative measures to stop people getting sick in the first place. You're a Liberal. How far down the path of nudge or indeed coercion would you go to help people keep themselves healthy? So, for example, a tax on fatty foods, sugary foods, whatever today's bogeyman is, how does that sit with your kind of Liberal philosophy?
I think it depends exactly what we're talking about. So I'd go some of the way. I'd have minimum pricing for alcohol, for example. I'm a strong supporter of plain packaging of cigarettes. So we're trying to cut back on the advertising of what are fundamentally deeply addictive products. But actually, as a Liberal, for me, a lot of it is about providing people with alternatives. Part of the problem is that in some parts of the country, it is actually quite hard to find non-fast food shops. You know, we've seen a bit more fruit available in a lot of shops. But even so, there's a lot of places where you go a long way to find bits of fruit that are readily available. Finding sweets, finding chocolate, no problem at all. So there's quite a lot you can do. But it's about things like eating. It's also about things like active transport. If people walk or cycle, that has huge benefits for the NHS. It saves a lot of money through reduced obesity, other physical health problems, cancer, a whole lot of things, and also mental health problems are reduced. So one study in The Lancet found that if we could get to the Dutch levels of cycling, it would save the NHS about £17 billion over a number of years. That's pretty good. And you do that by making it easy for people to walk, and easy for people to cycle and to do so safely. So encouraging people would always be my number one thing to try.
Okay. Thank you for answering those questions so far. We're now going to engage in the 1 minute round.
Oh, right. Okay.
Stiffen your sinews. Describe yourself in three words.
Scientist, politician from Cambridge. Lighting two there, sorry.
What's the last book you read?
Terry Pratchett's Guards.
Who would you choose to play you in a film of your life?
Oh, God.
No, you need to lean into the microphone so we can hear the answer.
I find it very hard to think of who would be good at doing that. I have no idea, sorry.
Okay. What's your guilty pleasure?
Listening to a whole range of weird and wonderful music. I have weirdly eclectic tastes that not everybody else likes.
Well, maybe we'll hear some of that later on the programme.
Hopefully the nicer stuff. But
and the mum's neck question. What's your favourite biscuit?
My favourite biscuits would probably be Dr. Karg. Does some very, very nice sort of ones.
Savoury ones.
Yeah, those are the ones.
I know what you mean. All right, we'll get back to the serious stuff now.
I'm trying to think of an actor as well while we're going to say.
In 2010, Liberal Democrats got a lot of support from voters who saw you as a kind of fresh alternative to the horrible Punch and Judy politics of Labour versus Conservative. In 2015, the party, I think it's pretty fair to say, has been contaminated by its involvement with the coalition. And there are two new parties at either end of the political spectrum which are now proclaiming their ambitions to shake up the status quo. In particular, what impact do you think the Green surge is going to have on the Liberal Democrat vote?
We'll have to see. I mean, we certainly did used to get a chunk of sort of protest vote, people who voted for us just because we weren't Labour or the Tories. And there's no doubt that we've lost that. And you know, there was no doubt that we would lose that as soon as we were in a government of any kind, because people would actually discover who we were. And it was interesting because there were people who voted for bad reasons in some sense, from all over the spectrum. And so those have gone, some to UKIP, some to Greens, some all over the place. The Green surge is an interesting thing. I think what's really happened is a huge change in the Green Party. And it used to be a very much environment-focused party. And it's now changed. And actually, the environment is not one of the main things they talk about. I think it was Rupert Reid, the Green candidate, was saying on Twitter a while back, he was complaining about somebody describing them as an environment-focused party. I'm very proud that the Lib Dems are an environment-focused party, that we want to do 5 green laws at the heart of what we've done, that we've almost tripled renewables. I wouldn't see it as a criticism. So the Greens have very much moved off to the left of Labour, taking the space that perhaps was old Labour, actually. And I think it's causing huge problems for Labour because, actually, the Greens are presenting a much more compelling case on many things than Labour are. There was, for example, a really interesting study by the UK Poverty Audit looking at the different parties' policies about what you do about poverty. It was really interesting to see what they said. They rated UKIP as the worst, not surprisingly, perhaps, then the Tories, then Labour, then us, then the Greens. I wish they hadn't looked at the Greens. Make a better story for me. But actually, the fact that we and the Greens are the ones leading that is a problem for Labour, because Labour, I think, hopes that people would assume that it was there for the entirety of the left. And actually, that's just not true. So there are lots of people on the left who are voting Green, if they're further left, or voting Lib Dem. I've had Labour Party members say they're going to vote for me. So
there we are, talking about the complexity of party affiliations and the tribal politics of yesteryear breaking down.
Well, I mean, I think we're still seeing too much tribalism, and unfortunately social media has catalysed that. But there are people who rise above it. So I'm incredibly heartened to have had Labour members donate money to my campaign, help me campaign, vote for me. Tory members donate, help, vote. Greens as well. I don't think I've had any UKIP members help me, but, you know. And actually, it's quite heartening that there are people who can rise above their party affiliations for the purpose of a local election here in Cambridge.
It seems pretty inevitable that no single party is going to be able to form
Absolutely.
A government. And so your party, even though its share of the vote is likely to fall reasonably substantially, could still be in the position of being kingmakers. So there's lots of discussion already about your party's red lines. Issuing a stability budget in the first 50 days, protecting education funding, committing to the tax-free thresholds rising to 12,500, not propping up any government held hostage by the SNP.
You've also missed out the health funding and the mental health as well.
Which was announced
today.
Yes, exactly.
But I mean, it's not a real surprise that these are the red lines, because actually it's the front page of the manifesto. And just like last time, we showed our top priorities on the front page of the manifesto, and we delivered almost everything that was on the front page. We're doing the same this time.
So you feel quite confident to go into negotiations with those as red lines that you're going to be able to defend?
We'll have to see. I mean, I think the big problem at the moment is that people are so busy ruling out deals. You know, we've had Ed Miliband say he'd rather have the Tories running the country than work with the SNP. I mean, that's an astonishing thing to say, that, you know, given everything else he's ever said, that I think we're going to have a real problem after the election, because I think it's going to be incredibly messy. But I think it would be very hard for us to do a coalition with people who said we will give schools less money than they need. I mean, I just couldn't do that.
You did a coalition with people
and we
who
stopped,
had a different attitude.
And
to
we stopped
fees.
The Tories from cutting schools funding. Absolutely. It was something we insisted on, and we won that. We wouldn't do a deal with somebody who said, we know the NHS needs 8 billion quid as a bare minimum, we're not going to do it. You know, we would force Labour to up their offer on the NHS. I think it's going to be really, really complex to see what happens. My gut sense is that we're not going to have a coalition.
Really?
My gut sense is that somebody will try to go it alone as minority government. And then we will see what happens. And I think it may be very chaotic.
Well, there's an attractive proposition. Right.
Well, what we need to do is to get to a transform our voting system so it's more sensible. I mean, you know, we got a quarter of the votes last time almost and got 1 in 11 MPs, which is just ridiculous. The SNP are likely to get, what, 5% of the vote? 50 MPs is the latest poll. Completely disproportionate. But also I think we need to get across the idea that politicians from different parties can work together. People see PMQs and all the bickering. But actually the truth is, when the cameras are off, we're quite capable of working together as mature adults. I've worked with Labour MPs on a range of things, worked a lot with Caroline Lucas from the Greens on a range of things. I've worked with Tory MPs on a range of things to push and advance lots of things. And actually it was heartening how many of those MPs said they hope I got re-elected.
So thinking about more collaborative models for government and extrapolating that to a local level, I want to know what you think about the city deal. And just for anyone who still isn't entirely clear about what this means, basically central government has guaranteed to local authorities that can achieve certain phased growth targets that they will get additional funding up to a maximum over a maximum of £1 billion over 15 years.
It's a Cambridge deal. It only applies to Greater Cambridge. It's what we negotiated and argued for.
Now, you were a local councillor in Cambridge for 8 years before you moved to Westminster. The city deal's only been in existence for 4 months. You've already felt moved to challenge some of the thinking that they were representing about what kind of transport plans would be appropriate for Milton Road. Do you think that this new body is sufficiently accountable to local councillors and through them to the electorate? Because I think a lot of people are very confused about where it sits in the ecosystem and what they can do to influence it.
I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think the city deal is brilliant. We got a substantially larger one than most other cities of a similar size. I'm really pleased about that. Some phenomenal work from Tim Bick and a whole range of other people. And it's good to see the City Council, South Cambs and the county working together. There's been too much bickering for a long time. But I don't think it's a perfect model at all. I mean, you pick up the Milton Road thing. What I was looking for was an assurance that there wouldn't be a dual carriageway, that we wouldn't lose the trees on Milton Road. I didn't get that at the time. I think they've now said they will do what I wanted, which is helpful. But also to make sure the community isn't dragged apart by whatever does happen there. So it's a huge opportunity. What I would like to see, and what I've argued for a really long time, is a unitary authority covering something like Cambridge and South Cam. So you have one council. And then it would become real easy because you wouldn't have to have this sort of slightly awkward joint thing because you'd have a council. We should fix how local elections work, by the way. STV would be a much better way of doing local council elections. But that would be a much better longer-term solution. But we can't just wait for everything to be perfect. We need the investment now.
If you personally lose your seat on Thursday, what would be your biggest regret?
I mean, obviously, I hope it doesn't happen. And I will probably first try and sleep and catch up because it's been an exhausting 5 years. I think there are a lot of really important things at stake in the next 5 years in a whole range of areas where I've been the person pushing them nationally. And if I'm not there, we just simply won't go the right way, we'll go backwards. A whole range of things. You know, I've led the fight to ban revenge porn and actually thinking about some of those issues that affect people. Not always the top headlines, but things that really make a difference to people caught up in it. I led the fight against the Snoopers Charter. Labour and the Tories have both been clear they want to bring in more monitoring of all our communications. I don't think the government should monitor everything we do on Facebook, every email you ever send, all the rest of it, every website you go to. And I think if I'm not there, then we will see far more authoritarian pushes. I led the fight to get child detention banned. The last government detained thousands of children at Yarlswood and other places. Would that have happened without me? Dunno. I've led the fight on drugs policy reform to say that we should have a sensible policy. We're now being attacked by Labour for arguing for sensible drugs policy reform. But we lock up about 1,000 people a year simply for possessing, not dealing even, drugs. You know, why are we spending money on that rather than on treating addicts? There's many, many more areas where I just don't think they'll get talked about, frankly.
Thank you very much for coming in today. To round off, we've asked all our interviewees to choose a record to play us out and let us know why they've picked it. So what's your choice?
It's, I think, a brilliant track. As I said, I have very eclectic musical tastes, but I do have a something of a taste for trance. This is the track that when I'm tired, when I need to get on and do things, if I play this, I just always wake up, focus, and I'm there. And it's Darude's Sandstorm.
Julian, thank you very much for coming in. Just a reminder that a full listing of all the candidates standing in the Cambridge City constituency is available on the Cambridge 105 website. And that's it for today's Election Studio and for the series. We're extremely grateful to all the candidates for coming in and talking to us so openly. If you need a recap on who said what, all four episodes of Election Studio will be available as podcasts on the Cambridge 105 website. And Cambridge 105 will have extensive coverage of the results and their implications from Thursday night onwards. And I'm going to leave you with a quote by none other than Winston Churchill, who said, "Many forms of government have been tried and will be tried in this world of sin and woe. No one pretends that democracy is perfect or all-wise. Indeed, it has been said that democracy is the worst form of government, except all those other forms that have been tried from time to time." Thank you for listening. Goodbye. We'll be right back.